Welcome to Knowing God in the Word, brought to you by the Word of Truth Ministry, publishers of Seed and Bread. I'm your host, Bob Juneau, with Bible teacher Nathan Johnson. This radio program is for the purpose of helping listeners fulfill the greatest need we have as believers, to know God. Please visit our website at knowinggodintheword.org for a study guide outline of today's lesson as Nathan will continue his teaching series on the book of John in chapter 21 with John's postscript, Untangling Peter. And now, Bible teacher Nathan Johnson.
Thanks, Bob. The book of John is really completed in chapter 20, verses 30 through 31, because there John states his premise and its conclusion. That is, that he's written this book to produce believers in the fact that Jesus is the Christ, one anointed or marked out by God to be the Savior of the world, and that Jesus is the Son of God, or God represented in human form, and that believing they might have life through his name. And if the book has achieved its purpose, then its readers now believe that. So the question then arises, why is there a chapter 21? Why does John continue for another chapter rather than ending with chapter 20? The other Gospels, they all end with the resurrection chapter is the last chapter. Matthew, Mark, and Luke, their last chapter is the chapter the resurrection takes place in. But John's resurrection chapter is chapter 20, and then there's a chapter 21. So why is this chapter there? Well, I think this chapter is there because John, as I said, assuming his readers have now believed his message, believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, that they're now believers, and now he wants to speak to his readers as new believers and answer what is perhaps every new believer's most important question, which is, now that I believe in Jesus Christ, the Son of God, what now? And so that's what this final chapter answers. What now? And it answers it through the example of Peter. Now, if we look at Peter, what we see of Peter before the cross is we see that Peter became a disciple of the Lord early. Remember, we saw back in John chapter 1, verses 40 through 41, where Peter came to be a disciple through the testimony of his brother Andrew, and he was one of the first disciples to start following the Lord. Now, he quickly moved up the ladder, we might say, and he became one of Christ's 12 special disciples, one of the 12, according to Matthew chapter 10 and verse 1. And then he did not just become part of the 12, but he became part of that special three, Peter, James, and John, who received the greatest revelations. For example, we see in Matthew chapter 17, verses 1 through 9, when the Lord went up onto the mountain of transfiguration, he only took those three, Peter, James, and John, along with him. Now, I suppose that Peter, like all the other disciples, must have been very proud of his position as the Lord's disciple, and even more so as part of the 12, and even part of the special three. I think we can see clearly that Peter had great ambition for his position, not just right now, but in the Lord's future kingdom to come. For example, in Matthew chapter 18 and verse 1, when we see all the disciples come to Jesus and say to him, who then is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? And they're hoping it'll be one of them. Same thing in Luke 22:24, where they were disputing, they're actually arguing as to which of them should be considered the greatest. Well, I suppose Peter had many arguments as to why he might be the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. He was an early disciple, one of the 12, one of the three. He might say that he was one of the closest to the Lord, one of the most faithful and loyal to the Lord. When the Lord had asked his disciples, who do you say that I am? Peter was the one who spoke up and said, you're the Christ, the Son of the living God. So he was the first one to speak up and say that. So he definitely could have argued that he maybe is the greatest of the disciples and could have been the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. So when the Lord came along and said something different, when the Lord in Matthew chapter 26 and verse 34 told Peter, assuredly, I say to you that this night before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times. No wonder Peter didn't believe him. Peter said to him, even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you. And he didn't believe he would ever deny the Lord. Now, as we talked about earlier, I suppose that what Peter had in mind was that he was standing next to the Lord in a final battle with the Roman army. and the Romans are attacking, and Peter is taking on maybe three Romans at once, and he's no longer just a fisherman who barely knows which end of the sword to grip. He's a mighty warrior, and he cuts down two of the Romans. Maybe the third stabs him through the heart. And as he's dying in the Lord's arms, he says, "Lord, I am just grateful that I was able to die on behalf of your kingdom." Well, I think that's what he was thinking about. So when the time actually came, and when the Lord just stood there and allowed himself to be arrested in the garden, and to die with him would have meant standing there to be arrested along with him, well, Peter was willing to do no such thing. He ran off and abandoned him. And I think Peter's view of the Lord was shaken at that point. Why would the Lord, if he truly was God, if he truly was all Peter thought he was, why would he allow such a thing? Rather than conquering, why would he allow himself to be conquered? But Peter, as we saw, at least tried to stick close to the Lord. He and John followed the Lord to the place where the Lord was on trial, and Peter was standing there trying to find out what was going to happen to the Lord. But these annoying servant girls start speaking up and accusing him of being one of the Lord's disciples. And I suppose in Peter's mind, he just wants to be able to stay there and see what happens to the Lord if these people would just leave him alone. So he says, no, I'm not one of his disciples. He's just hoping they'll leave him alone. But having established that as the policy is, they bug him more and more, won't leave him alone. He keeps denying it more and more. Finally ends up cursing and swearing that he never knew the Lord. And then the Lord turned and looked at Peter, according to the book of Luke. And at that point, I think Peter's view of himself was destroyed. He thought he was the greatest of the disciples. He thought he had good arguments when they were arguing about who was the greatest. But now, he appeared to not be the greatest at all. He denied the Lord three times. And then when the Lord died on the cross, when that was the outcome of the trial, it must have seemed to Peter like everything he had hoped for, both in the Lord and in himself, was destroyed. Now that lasted for 3 days. But on the third day, the Lord rose from the dead. And certainly the resurrection must have restored Peter's view of the Lord. The Lord was everything Peter thought he was. In fact, he was even greater than Peter had imagined. He was able to conquer death from the inside. However, though his view of the Lord was restored, his view of himself was not. And surely, Peter must now have looked at himself as just kind of a silly backwoods fisherman who had gotten involved in politics and gotten involved in kingdoms and great works of God, things that were far too out of reach for him, far too high for a man like him, and he surely is not qualified to rule in the Lord's great kingdom to come. So he figures at this point, he had better go back to the only thing he's really good at, fishing. And now he's probably imagining himself in God's kingdom. Christ is conquered like Peter knew he would. He's in Jerusalem. He's reigning in glory, and all Jerusalem is glowing with a heavenly light, and angels are ascending and descending on the Son of Man, just like Christ said they would. And Peter, he's off at the Sea of Galilee, and he's out in his little fishing boat, and probably the sky is cloudy, and it's dark and drizzly, and Peter's out there casting his net into the sea, a tear running down his cheek. There he is, fishing, the only thing Peter's good for. So that's, I think, Peter's mental state and the state Peter is in when we get to John chapter 21. In verse 1, it says, "After these things, Jesus showed himself again to the disciples at the Sea of Tiberias, and in this way he showed himself." So we get to John chapter 21, and it tells us that the Lord is going to show himself again to his disciples at the Sea of Tiberias. Now, the Sea of Tiberias, that's also known as the Sea of Galilee. And it's that sea up in the northeast part of Israel. The Jordan River flows out of it and then flows down to the Dead Sea. And that forms much of the eastern border of the main part of the land of Israel. And that's where they are. Remember, the Lord Jesus had told his disciples to go before him into Galilee. They had gone there. And that's why they're there at the Sea of Galilee, the Sea of Tiberias. Verse 2. "Simon Peter, Thomas called the twin, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two others of the disciples were together." So we read that there were actually seven of the disciples who were together. And of course, first and foremost among them was Peter. But there was also Thomas the twin, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, and as we talked about him earlier, he's never actually named as being one of the 12, but a lot of people think maybe he was Bartholomew in the lists of the 12. If he wasn't, he just must have been another one of his disciples who never made it to the 12. Then he says the sons of Zebedee. Well, there John goes again, talking about himself, the author of the book, as if he was talking about someone else. Because, of course, it is John, the author himself, and James, his brother, who are the sons of Zebedee. But he follows his policy of never naming himself directly in his own book, because he wants all the glory to go to the Lord and unto himself. And then there were two others of his disciples. And I don't know why it doesn't name them. Either they weren't among the 12, which is quite possible, or else maybe they were members of the 12, but some of the lesser known ones. So John just doesn't bother to name them here. So they're all together. Verse 3, Simon Peter said to them, I am going fishing. They said to him, we are going with you also. They went out and immediately got into the boat, and that night they caught nothing. Now here again, I think that Peter is thinking that this is all he's good for. He figures that when it came time to really show what he was really made of, he made out very badly. In fact, the only one who really did worse than Peter was Judas. And that's not saying much. But none of the other 12 had denied the Lord 3 times. Yes, they'd all run away, but none of them had denied knowing him 3 times and cursed and sworn that, as Peter had done. So Peter figures fishing is all he's good at. He might as well go back to that and forget about great things like kingdoms. Now his other disciples who were there speak up and said, we'll go with you too. And many of these disciples, perhaps all these disciples, had been fishermen before they became disciples. Now we have to think somewhat about what must have been going through the other disciples' minds as well. And they hadn't messed up as badly as Peter, but still when the time came to stick with the Lord, they had all abandoned him. They had all gone running away and hid themselves. And they'd failed to stick by him. And it had become obvious by now that things weren't going to go back to the way they were before. The Lord didn't just rise from the dead, rejoin his disciples, and they go around ministering just like they'd done before. He could have done that, but it was becoming clear now that he wasn't going to. And things were going to be different now. And maybe even though before they had known and had admitted that he was the Christ, the Messiah, and they had admitted even that he was the Son of God, well, it was one thing to say that, but it's another thing to actually meet a man who had conquered death from the inside. And I think they probably all felt like the Lord had perhaps grown beyond them at this point, or else their view of him had gotten so much bigger that it seemed to them, what could they do? How could they possibly be a disciple of someone who had risen from the dead, who had power even over death? So they're figuring they're only good for fishing too. So they go out and they go fishing, and now the funny thing, the ironic thing is that they don't catch anything. Here they're thinking fishing's the only thing they're good at, and they can't even seem to do that anymore. They go out fishing and they catch nothing. Verse 4, but when the morning had now come, Jesus stood on the shore, yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. So when the morning comes, the Lord appears to them, and probably appears where they were planning to land the boat. However, they don't recognize him, and that's probably due to the distance from the shore. As we'll see a little bit later, they were about a football field, about 100 yards from the shore. And if you're trying to see a figure standing on the shore from that distance, you can see somebody's there, but you'd probably have trouble making out who it was. So if they see somebody standing there, they don't know who it was. Now, it could also be that he hid their eyes from recognizing him like he did in Luke 24, verse 16. But I don't think so. I don't think that was necessary. They were just too far away to recognize him. Verse 5. Then Jesus said to them, children, have you any food? They answered him, no. So the Lord calls them and asks them if they have any food. In other words, if they've caught anything. Now he knows that they do not have anything, but he is setting up the miracle that he's about to perform. Now I suppose that they probably thought this was Zebedee. Remember, Zebedee was the father of James and John. Now, Simon Peter and Andrew, they were fishermen too, but they all seem to have worked for Zebedee. And Zebedee seems to have owned the fishing business that they worked for. Remember, I told you there's some evidence that perhaps James, John, and their father were part of the rich ruling class. And so it would make sense that they would have owned the business. So they maybe think it's Zebedee, the owner of the business, calling to them. And they're answering him. They don't realize it's the Lord. Verse 6. And he said to them, cast the net on the right side of the boat, and you will find some. So they cast, and now they were not able to draw it in because of the multitude of fish. So he calls to them and tells them to cast their net on the right side of the boat, and they'll find some. Now, some people have jumped to the conclusion here that this means they must have only been fishing off the left side of the boat all night. And if they'd only fished off the right side of the boat, then they would have caught something. Well, I don't see any evidence here that they'd only fished off the left side. Why wouldn't they have switched sides back and forth? And even if they had only fished off the left side, what does it matter? Are the fish going to bite better depending on which side of the boat you cast your net off of? No, that doesn't make any sense. The point here is that he wants them to believe his word. He wants them to show faith, not that they were fishing off the wrong side. And this was a command to follow, and if they obeyed the command, that showed faith, that showed obedience. Now, the fish hadn't bit all night, and at night is when the fish really bite on the Sea of Galilee, and they knew that. So now in the morning, to cast their net out and try to catch something, when all night they hadn't caught anything, when the fishing was much better, well, that was just ridiculous. But they do it anyway, they show faith, and now their net is so full of fish that it's too heavy for them to even lift it back into the boat. There are so many fish in it. Now, this is actually the eighth sign of the book of John. Remember, we've talked about in the book of John that the miracles that are recorded here are never called miracles. They're actually called signs, semeion in Greek. But it means signs. And these are signs pointing to the reality of John's great premise, that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. And we also talked about the fact that these signs correspond, the first with the eighth, the second with the seventh, the third with the sixth, and the fourth with the fifth. So this is the final and the eighth sign occurring here in the postscript to John. And it corresponds to the first sign, which was the changing of the water into wine, back in John chapter 2. Now, both of these signs show the Lord's power over nature. And that is, of course, as the Son of God. God is the one who created nature, so he has power over it. We see both the first and the last signs involved a command. In the case of the first sign, he said, "Fill the water pots with water." And here he said, "Cast the net." And we see that the first sign was actually in a prologue to his ministry, according to the Lord's words in John chapter 2 and verse 4. When his mother asked him to perform this miracle, he said, "Woman, what does your concern have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." So he said, it's not yet time for me to perform miracles. But since his mother asked him, he did. He did it a little early. So that was kind of in a prologue to his ministry, and this one is actually in a postscript to his ministry. So we see how this sign and the first sign correspond. Verse 7, "Therefore that disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, 'It is the Lord.' Now when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he had removed it, and plunged into the sea." So at this point, the disciple whom Jesus loved recognizes that it's the Lord. And of course, the disciple whom Jesus loved is John himself, the author of the book. And he's doing what he always does, talking about himself like he's talking about someone else in his book. Now, he realizes he must be the Lord Jesus. And if we compare this to Luke chapter 5, verses 1 through 11, when early in his ministry, the Lord had performed a miracle almost exactly similar to this, we can see why John recognized the Lord at this point. He recognized the miracle. Now, Peter, as we've seen, he is thinking that he's not worthy to be with the Lord. And yet, just because he's thinking that, that hasn't changed his heart. The fact is that Peter is still eager to be with the Lord. He still wants to be with him. He just doesn't believe he's worthy to be with him anymore. So when he finds out that this is the Lord, he can't wait for the boat to draw into the shore. He actually plunges into the sea. And he throws back on his outer garment first to do it. Back then when they were working, they would take off their outer robes and just wear their inner robe, what we would call their under robe, while they were working. And that's what he had done. So he throws his outer robes back on, and he plunges into the sea and wades into shore while the other disciples bring the boat in. Verse 8, "But the other disciples came in the little boat, for they were not far from land, but about 200 cubits, dragging the net with fish." So the other disciples bring the little boat they were using in, and because they can't lift the net, they just have to drag the net to land. So I'm sure that slowed them down, and was one reason Peter wasn't patient, wasn't willing to wait. But they come in dragging that net full of fish. And here we see that they were 200 cubits from shore, and a cubit is about a foot and a half. So that's why I said they were a football field, 100 yards from shore. Verse 9. "Then, as soon as they had come to land, they saw a fire of coals there, and fish laid on it, and bread." So we see that the Lord was waiting for them, and he had been preparing breakfast. And he had a fish laid on the fire, a little fish, and some bread cooking there. Now, one interesting thing that this shows us is that this shows us most definitely that the Lord was not a vegetarian. He was cooking fish for his meal. And some people today want to promote vegetarianism and say it's the only godly way to be. They might not like this fact, but it's true. The fact is that it's God himself who instituted the eating of meat in Genesis chapter 9, verse 3, when he said, "Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. I have given you all things, even as the green herbs." That's what he said to Noah. Now that changed, after the flood, what the Lord had instituted after creation before the flood. And we see that in Genesis 1:29, when God said, "See, I have given you every herb that yields seed, which is on the face of all the earth, and every tree whose fruit yields seed, to you it shall be for food. Also to every beast of the earth, to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth, in which there is life, I have given every green herb for food. And it was so. So the Lord had originally created creation, both humans and animals, to eat only vegetables. Now I believe that the flood had damaged the earth's ecosystem to the point where vegetables just weren't nutritious enough for many of the higher energy animals. And so God changed it to the eating of meat. Now some people today want to undo that and say, we don't like violence, we don't like the killing of animals, so we're going to go back to being a vegetarian. Well, I think they don't realize how many animals are killed from plowing up the grain in a field. A lot of little field mice and moles and so forth get killed when you're plowing a field. So it's not like animals aren't getting killed for your food just because you're a vegetarian. But the fact is that the Lord established the eating of meat for today. And for us to reject God's plan for today and go back to a previous plan is an error. It's like the error of the Israelites in Numbers 14, when after they whined and said they didn't want to go into the promised land, the Lord said to them, okay, you're not going to go in. You'll wander in the wilderness for 40 years. And they turned around and said, oh, never mind, we'll go into the land now. And they went in. Well, the Lord had changed the plan. And they were defeated by their enemies. And they couldn't go in after the Lord had changed the plan. So I don't think it's a good idea to try to go back to a previous plan that the Lord has changed. I think the Lord gave us meat to eat today, and it would be best for us to do it. Verse 10, Jesus said to them, bring some of the fish which you have just caught. So the Lord only had maybe one person's breakfast cooking here, and he says, bring some of the fish you caught, and we'll make a bigger breakfast. We'll make breakfast for everybody. He only has one fish and loaf, but they have plenty of fishes to feed everyone. Now this is kind of opposite of the miracle of the feeding of the 5,000, where they didn't have enough food. They brought it to the Lord, and he multiplied it into plenty of food. Here it's actually the Lord who doesn't have enough food, but he gave them the power to catch plenty of food to easily feed them and plenty more people besides. And maybe that's a reflection of what was the Lord was about to do. He was about to give them the power to carry on the work that he had been doing previously. Verse 11. Simon Peter went up and dragged the net to land full of large fish, 153. And although there were so many, the net was not broken. And we see this. Peter is still eager not only to be with the Lord, but to obey his commands. In spite of his failure earlier, he really wants to serve the Lord. He just doesn't think he's worthy of doing it anymore. So the question is, will the Lord allow him to continue to serve him? Well, he pulls the net in, and they actually count the fish in the net at 153. And with this many, we can see that the net not breaking was also a miracle. It was also part of the miracle. The net should have broken with that many fish in it. Verse 12, Jesus said to them, come and eat breakfast. Yet none of the disciples dared to ask him, who are you? Knowing it was the Lord. So here they are, they're eating with the Lord just like they had done for 3 years. And this time is much the same. And yet to them, how different it seemed. Before they'd been comfortable in the Lord's presence, but now they had risen from the dead, they must be almost afraid of him now. Yet verse 13, Jesus then came and took the bread and gave it to them, and likewise the fish. So their view of the Lord might have changed, but the Lord himself had not changed. He's still just as willing to serve his disciples. Even though he's their master, he's willing to serve them and give them the food, just like he had been willing to do before he died and rose from the dead. So the Lord, his basic character, his nature hasn't changed. It's just their view of him has become more exalted. Verse 14. This is now the third time Jesus showed himself to his disciples after he was raised from the dead. So this was his third appearance to the majority of his disciples. Now we realize there are only seven of them here, but that's still a majority. Now, of course, this is not including his appearances to the women or to Peter alone, like we see in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 5, or Luke 24, 34. That was just a personal appearance to Peter. But this is his third appearance to the majority of his disciples. So we see in John chapter 21 that John's theme is complete, asking the reader to believe. And so if we ask, why then does this postscript exist? The answer is that there is still the matter of Peter to settle. His belief in the Lord was justified by his resurrection, but his belief in himself is still in shambles. He wants to serve the Lord, but he does not know how, and doesn't even think that he deserves to. Yet the Lord still wants to be with Peter. And praise God that the Lord loves us, even when we let him down. How great his grace is.
The postscript in John will show that Peter's willingness to serve the Lord is strong, but Peter will need his attitude changed about some things. We will see this next week in the closing words of the book of John. Thank you, Nathan, for your lesson on the Book of John. On our next program, Nathan will continue his teaching series in the Book of John with John's Postscript, What Now? Thank you for joining us today. Our hope is that as you learn more of God's Word, you know God more. For more information on the program, to hear past programs, and for other downloadable material that Nathan has produced, please visit our website at knowinggodintheword.org. We also offer a free weekly email newsletter. Currently, Nathan is studying through the book of 1 Timothy in this newsletter, and he is doing the same thing he does on this radio program, going through verse by verse through 1 Timothy, and then discussing what it means. Email Nathan at nathan@knowinggodintheword.org and ask to be placed on his mailing list. You can also write to us with Bible questions or comments. We would like to invite you to the Word of Truth Ministry Fall Bible Conference 2016. This year's topic will be Making Sense of Bible Prophecy. We will have several different speakers teaching on several different subjects related to Bible prophecy, with time for questions and answers after each speaker. Please join us on Saturday and Sunday, August 27th and 28th at Bloomington Courtyard Marriott, 7800 Bloomington Avenue, Bloomington, Minnesota. Remember, that's August 27th and 28th. We hope to see you there. I'm your host, Bob Juno, with Bible teacher Nathan Johnson. We'll say goodbye for now, but we look forward to you joining us next week on Knowing God in the Word.